The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I am Katie Rhodes, proud member of the Pepper Society and co-chair of the Pepper Council. The Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. Tonight's lecture and many other thought-provoking programs that stimulate active civic dialogue and are only made possible through the generous private support. The library serves as a resource to millions of people annually, and it provides a variety of educational cultural opportunities for people of all ages. I thank you for considering supporting this critical work by making a gift. It is my great pleasure to introduce Gary Sterngart, who since 2002 has shared with appreciative readers a series of critically and popularly acclaimed contributions to American literature. Time magazine described Gary Sterngart's work as ridiculously witty and painfully prescient. He is the author of the culturally astute and insightful novels The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story, and the memoir Little Failure, which was a National Book Critics Award finalist. Lake Success, his new novel, is a road trip tale of a billionaire hedge fund owner manager who flees New York City by bus in search of a simpler life. The New York Times Book Review describes Lake Success as light, stinging, insolent, and melancholy. Of Sterngart, it continued, the wit, the immigrant's sense of heartbreak, he was born in Russia, just seemed to pour from him. He doesn't disappoint. We are so pleased to have him here, and he will be out in a minute, but first we're going to show a short video.
Hey, are you white?
Are you a male?
Did you play lacrosse at one of these 14 schools?
Then the exciting world of hedge funds might be right for you.
Hi, I'm Ben Stiller.
And I'm Gary Sterngart. And together we're
Lake Success Capital! Woo!
Bro, you might be wondering, how do hedge funds work? Bro, you might be wondering, what is a hedge fund?
Hedge funds take money from accredited investors.
Like your mom's.
And then transfer that money to me and Ben.
And then we, like, invest that money into stuff.
Sometimes really weird stuff.
Dudes, I just lost $500 million on llama futures.
That's cool, bro.
We want you to fail.
That's how white people learn.
Oh!
Do you want to learn more about hedge funds or how to get one of these vests? Then check out Gary's novel, Lake Success. Bro.
Read the book, then dial 1-800-SUCCESS and come in for an interview, Brozak.
Lake Success Capital! Yeah!
Hey guys! I just lost more money.
Please welcome Gary Sterngart.
All right. Hello, Philadelphia. Woo! Are you ready to invest in my hedge fund? Yeah, you're wondering where Ben is. He's touring the country on a roadshow trying to raise capital. We've had a great first year at Lake Success. We're down 22%. Down is the new flat. You know, it's really exciting. We're investing in all kinds of complete nonsense. This is like my 10th reading here. I feel so at home here. This is just such a friendly place, only an hour away from where I live. Yeah. Yeah, I like Philly. And this book has a very bright cover, you know, so don't be intimidated by that, but it's very bright. And this is, the hero of Lake Success is Barry Cohen, who is a hedge fund manager, like Ben Stiller and myself. To be more precise, he's running a hedge fund into the ground while being investigated by the SEC. These things happen. As the novel starts, Barry decides to run away from his failing marriage, his failing fund, and his autistic son on a Greyhound bus to pursue his college girlfriend in El Paso, Texas. Now, what could drive someone, anyone, away from their family when they need him so much? Yes, Barry is what in Yiddish is called a schmuck. He is also a small-time gunniff, or crook, right? And as he depletes his funds on his journey across the country, he also becomes a schnorrer, or beggar. Never say you don't learn anything at a Gary Steingart reading. I've just taught you all the Yiddish you'll ever really need to know, especially if you're interested in finance. May I ask if someone could turn off that big blue light? Sorry. It's lovely. It's kind of like... in Fitzgerald's, The Great Gatsby, except it's not green. It's blue, and it's beaming toward me in this. Oh, there you go. Brilliant. Now, that is Philly adaptation. They put a book in front of it to make the light go away. You guys are the best. Thank you. Now, people have asked me, why did you write a book about a hedge fund guy? You know, why not your usual Russian losers? You know, why not write about yourself some more? Well, in the past decade, I became aware of the fact that a large number of the friends I had come of age with in Manhattan were gone, displaced by rising costs to Berlin or LA or the Mid-Hudson Valley or Philadelphia. Yeah, yeah. My friends, many of whom were alumni, fellow alumni, I should say, of Stuyvesant High School and Oberlin College, worked as writers and graphic designers, academics and journalists, the heart of what used to be the creative middle class. But they were all gone. And as I walked down the now unfamiliar streets of my city, eyeing a new breed of closely shaved, athletic individuals, I kept wondering, who are these people? Upon closer inspection, I discovered they mostly worked for banks or hedge funds or private equity firms. Now, I've met only a couple of bankers in my life, but around 2012, I decided my next novel would be about finance since there was nobody else left to write about in Manhattan. And I realized pretty early on in my research that people in finance often had a different view of reality from most of the other people I'd previously known. An older currency trader at a massive bank complained to me of the struggles of the middle class. And when I asked them to define the middle class, he said, people like me, just people struggling. And I said, could you give me a number? He's like, well, earning between $2 and $4 million a year, just trying to make ends meet. So when it was time to cobble together a character like Barry Cohen, who earns a lot more than $4 million a year, I kept thinking back to all the wonderful, deluded people I had met along the way. So I'll read you a chapter from Lake Success, or part of a chapter, I should say, to introduce you to Barry Cohen. This scene, so he really takes a Greyhound across the country, as did I. Boy, do I suffer for my art. And this is somewhere midway in the book where Barry gets off the bus in the middle of his journey in Atlanta, and he's there to visit his protege, Jeff Park, whom he actually fired from his hedge fund at one point. He's almost run out of money because he's left New York with nothing but a rollerboard full of watches. He's a watch collector. Look out for those. And he also had to get rid of his credit card. So he's in Atlanta to beg Jeff Park for a little bit of a bridge loan to fund his journey, his Greyhound ride across the country. That's him being a schnorrer, by the way. Even the water's good here. Wow. Jeff Park's living room was as palatial as the entrance to a modest New York museum. Enormous golden lights hung from the ceiling, which was at least 20 feet in height. Jeff had a full head of hair, gums that didn't recede, and he did push-ups in the middle of the day. He had gone to Cornell, but had not played lacrosse like most of the guys at Barry's hedge fund. "So what's up, Barry?" Jeff said. "Just passing through. decided to look me up. They were sitting in Jeff's kitchen. He had brought out a bottle of Yamazaki 20 Year and was serving it straight up, quite decadent for 1:27 p.m. What the hell did Jeff Park do for a living? He had cashed out of Barry's hedge fund with zero. All of this is going to sound crazy, Barry said. Uh-huh. I'm on a journey by bus. Barry knew that he would eventually have to explain his flight from New York to people in his tax bracket. He knew that news of his meltdown would immediately form the latest bulletin in the incestuous, bloodthirsty world from which he had sprung. But he doubted it would really surprise anyone. The people in his world could be nuts. One fund was essentially a cult with its own Bible, ritual mind control, and feats of strength. One fellow at another fund, a quant billionaire in training, played piano at a third-rate bar while passing around a tip jar. Like your first ankle monitor bracelet or your fourth divorce, the occasional break with reality was an important part of any hedge fund titan's biography. The things I've seen, Barry said, and he told Jeff a few of his Greyhound adventures so far. Jeff Park seemed interested. He poured more drinks, although he insisted Barry chase his with water. It sounds a bit like you're doing a middle-aged version of On the Road, he said. Like the one-eyed Mexican guy in New Jersey you said fell asleep on your shoulder? That sounds pretty Kerouac. That's exactly right, Barry shouted. Oh, no wonder he had picked Jeff Park to host him. The man had literary sensibilities beyond most of his colleagues. They really did a good job of educating up at Cornell. I used to take the Greyhound to visit my uncle's family in Savannah, Jeff said. Everyone there looked at us like we were freaks. Everyone looks at me like I'm a freak. You kind of are a freak, Barry. Barry took that as the highest of compliments. He was bonding with this former employee whom he had fired. They were going to be friends now. So are you from around here originally, he asked. Yeah, I moved back down to take care of my parents. Your parents are, I want to say, from China. Close enough, Jeff Park said. My wife is Indian, Barry said. Rock, Jeff said. You ought to get married, Barry said, completely forgetting that his own marriage was but a team of seven lawyers short of kaput. His instinct to help Jeff Park was overwhelming. He remembered his wife's friend, the Asian woman from Brooklyn, Tina, Lena. I threw away my cell phone, Barry said. Can I check something on your computer? A laptop was provided. It had been a week since he had touched a keyboard. He brought up his wife's profile. What a gorgeous family you have, Jeff Park said, pointing at the profile photo of his wife and son. When I worked for you, I think you were just about to get married. Gosh, that kid of yours, those beautiful eyes. Yeah, Barry said, his hand frozen over the keyboard. Yeah, that's nice. But here's what I really wanted to show you. He scrolled through the list of Seema's friends until he found the right one. Now, this girl is spunky, he said. She called me a tool to my face. And I think she's pretty intellectual like you. Oh, one night in Brooklyn, she made these great Chinese dumplings for us. I bet your folks would love her. Mina Kim, Jeff Park read off the screen. Ah, not really up my alley. Barry was heartbroken. But she's Chinese. Jeff Park stared at him. I'm more into the Southern Belle type, he finally said. Ah, Barry sighed. But thanks for looking out for me. You're like that woman from Fiddler on the Roof. Barry sort of knew what he was talking about. Matchmaker, matchmaker. Jeff Park had a wide cultural reach. Well, I'm going to make it my mission to get you married, he said. Nice guy like you. I'm not averse to the ladies, Jeff Park said. I've designed this place with them in mind. Huh, how so? Jeff Park took him on a tour, starting with a massive glass-topped dining table. You see these lights, he said, pointing out a trio of Sputnik-style globes hanging over the mirrored surface. The average girl I date is 5'6", or an inch taller than the national average. I have a spreadsheet that lists the attributes of each girl I've ever dated. It's super granular. So if I'm making her dinner, and she's standing here waiting for me, talking to me, maybe having a drink, the light from these lamps is directly level with her eyes. She can see better, and I can enjoy her glow. Barry was impressed by Jeff Park's thoughtfulness. a spreadsheet. The rap on guys in finance was all wrong. They care too much. He knew he did. If you looked at it a certain way, he had abandoned his family because he didn't have the emotional bandwidth to accommodate their special needs. He examined an enormous couch. Now, this sofa is the perfect height for a 5'6" woman, Jeff Park said. When she sits down, the sofa waterfalls at the back of her knees. He invited Barry to sit down. See, there's a gap of at least 3 inches between the back of your knee and the couch because you're tall, but if you were a 5'6" woman, you'd be completely snug. So you only date women of that height? Barry asked. Well, there's some variance, Jeff Park said. Maybe half a sigma. I don't want the tail wagging the dog, but yeah, mostly. You're a romantic, Barry said. Jeff Park shrugged and blushed. He was not unhandsome. His face was chiseled and tanned to perfection. The black athletic gear he was wearing made him look like a glossy seal in human form. Only the Rolex Skydweller on his wrist did not appeal to Barry's taste. Upstairs, Jeff had an airy office with full view of Atlanta's Midtown. Barry felt a twinge of passion at the sight of a fully operating Bloomberg terminal, which he hadn't seen in a week. Jeff Park had only one screen going, which was cute. On a glass board, he had sketched out some trades that appeared exceptionally long-term and cautious, making some kind of play around Alcoa and Dow. Just scanning the numbers on the board, Barry assumed an AUM, assets under management, of $35 million, which in the best of worlds brought in, what, a couple million a year? He probably had a net worth of like $10, $15 million, and he could live on that and be happy and buy couches that waterfall the legs of median women. I trade maybe 2 hours in the morning, Jeff Park said, and then I spend the rest of the day working on myself. I read at least 100 books a year, and if I'm at, let's say, 70 books by November, I'll take the rest of the year off to catch up. I like reading books of the girls I date. Beckett plays, Chekhov stories, Shakespeare sonnets. Believe me, they need culture around these parts. Wonderful, just wonderful, Barry said. This is what I'm talking about. This is real self-improvement, a vocation and an avocation. So many guys say, I want to die at my peak net worth, Jeff Park said. But not me. Clearly not, Barry said. Jeff now led him into a bathroom. They were looking at the double mirrors that functioned as TVs in the rain shower tub. I'm glad you're laughing. That's my favorite sentence of the whole book. I don't know why. It's just rain shower tub to me. To me, that's funny. Okay. If maybe you have one. If so, I apologize. But if you don't have one, let's laugh at it together. Rain shower tub. The GOP convention in Cleveland was in full blaze. Ted Cruz was saying he would not be voting for Hillary on the TV, but he wasn't going to endorse Trump either. I used to stay at the Trump Hotel in Columbus Circle whenever I visited New York, Jeff Park said. Never again. I'm a moderate Republican, Barry said. Socially liberal. I'm on a Greyhound bus, for Christ's sake. They went downstairs for a new course of drink. Jeff Park was making them with ruby red vodka and Seagram soda now. They sat at a table made from the cross-section of a giant tree. Its height was also designed to seduce an average woman. Barry felt around the serrated bark of the edges. He liked his furniture slightly rustic with hints, just hints, of the arts and crafts movement. That was supposed to be the motif of his Rhinebeck house if he ever finished it. Who made this? Barry asked. Ah, it's a Japanese eucalypti, Jeff Park said. I bought it in Kokura. It reminds me of how lucky I am. Kokura, Barry said. Yeah, you never heard of the luck of Kokura? Barry shook his head. Well, it was August 9th, 1945. There was an American bomber headed to bomb Kokura on the island of Tinian, but there was too much cloud cover over the city that day, so the plane was diverted to Nagasaki. Wow, Barry said. Lucky for Kokura. Right. Luck. If I were born in Bangladesh, let's say, to a family of rag pickers, would any of this happen? He gestured at his 4,500 square feet of property. My mother worked as a maid in Buckhead when they got here. I still remember the food stamps with the drawings of the old whiteys signing the Declaration of Independence. I memorized the words on it, U.S. Department of Agriculture food coupon. Where else could a maid's son end up like this? That's why I'll always take care of my folks, why I'll always live in the same town as them. I've got to honor the luck that was given me. Barry thought of his own relationship with his parents. His mother had died in a car accident when he was 5, and then he had bought out his father's swimming pool company for $4 million, about 10 times what it was worth, so that his dad could finally retire. But after that gesture, and after his father's openly racist behavior at his wedding, he mostly avoided the old man. He went out just once to La Jolla, California, where his father was living with his girlfriend, Netta, whom he had found in an online Zionist forum. Netta was a former social worker and had 2 grown kids in L.A. The moment she met him, she pressed Barry into her freckled décolletage and proceeded to give him a detailed tour of her beautiful garden, where she and Barry's father spent most of their time drinking coffee and looking at their laptops. Her house was a 1940s U-shaped ranch with back-to-back fireplaces, wild beehives in the pepper trees, little gardens of shiso leaf and miniature roses, 2 box turtles and a rabbit named Sylvester. There were plums that Netta's kids used to throw on the street to watch them get run over, and blood orange shrubs in the front yard, and in the middle of what even the Holy Bible would have to acknowledge to be the true Garden of Eden, sat 2 elderly people in their Make America Great Again caps, silently scrolling through the latest outrage to their common gene pool in the dusty hills and valleys of another land. "I'm so sorry about your son getting autism," Netta had said. "Did you give him vaccines? I'm sure that's what did it." "I told him not to get the vaccines," his father hollered from his perch beneath a plum tree. "I sent him the Facebook link about how the Somalian Muslims were spreading it through their doctors in Minnesota." Barry was out of there in less than 36 hours. 8 months later, his father was dead of pancreatic cancer. Maybe Jeff Park was just a better son, and maybe better sons made for better people, and that's why their mothers didn't die in car accidents, their faces caked in blood. "But that's not luck," Barry said, returning to the theme of the conversation. "Yeah, okay, sure. It's helpful not to be born to rag pickers in Bangladesh or whatever. But mostly your success was a result of your own hard work, Jeff, and your parents' gumption to move here." "You don't consider yourself lucky?" Jeff Park said. "Not for a minute," Barry said. "I never had any advantages. I wasn't even lucky enough to be born an immigrant." Jeff Park laughed. "Now that's funny," he said. So now we're going to skip ahead a little bit toward the end of the chapter. I'll summarize quickly. A lot has happened. Barry and Jeff's bromance has truly grown. They've compared their watch collections, which is what people in finance do when they really like one another. And they've been all over Atlanta. And the previous night, the two of them went to Buckhead, a wealthy suburb, to watch the GOP convention in Cleveland. By the way, this is 2016. Did I announce that? Oh, okay. It is. After their wild night out, Barry put his hand on Jeff Park's shoulder in a very ambiguous way on the ride home, and this leads to problems between them the next day. One last thing about this part. Barry is being investigated by the government for trades on 2 companies. One is called Value Pro, and the other is called Gastrolux, and they've hiked up the prices for certain medications, and Jeff Park's father was on one of those medications. It was early morning, raining. The Atlanta skyline was covered in gloom. Barry carried his sorrow before him. "So I think it's time for me to shove off," he said. Jeff Park was eating nuts for breakfast and sipping on a macchiato. "Okay," he said. "Yeah, gotta head to old El Paso," Barry said. "See an old friend of mine, an ex-girlfriend." Jeff Park smiled. "Props to your wanderlust," he said. Barry sat himself up on the counter. "This is going to sound embarrassing," he said. "I'm going to need a tiny bridge loan to get me to El Paso. I don't have access to my funds at the moment. It's complicated. Maybe $2,000? "I can't do that, Barry," Jeff said. That hurt Barry right away. "Why not? You've accommodated me for this long. This is just a loan." "You're welcome to my house, always. But I can't stake you." "Who's talking steak? $2,000, that's 4% of the cost of your Rolex Skydweller. I feel like I'm getting mixed signals from you." Jeff Park looked down at his lap. "You fired me, Barry," he said. "Ah, so there it was, finally." "It wasn't me," Barry said. "It was Akash Singh. Everything at that fund happens because of Akash Singh. I'm just the figurehead." "You were there. You invited me out to breakfast at Castle Lever, and when I got there, it was just you and the lawyer. What did the lawyer say? 'I'm afraid we're going to have to part ways.'" "Yeah, okay, but that's how it's done. That's just, you know, the legal way." "You didn't say one word to me," Jeff said. "I wasn't allowed to say one word. And I thought of you as a mentor almost." Barry sighed. "I'm in genuine pain," he said. "So much of the time. Doesn't that deserve something?" "Attention must be paid," Jeff Park said. "What?" "Death of a salesman." "Oh, not right now," Barry said. "I wish you'd been straight with me," Jeff Park said. "What do you mean straight? You don't have any credit cards. You don't have a cell phone. You travel on a bus where you can pay for the tickets in cash. Was it that Gastrolux trade? I mean, have you been subpoenaed? Are they after you? Did you get your Wells notice yet?" "I didn't do anything wrong," Barry said. "It's a witch hunt." "The government is after anyone who makes money, anyone who has friends." "My father used hydroandetone," Jeff said. "The diuretic. Frankly, he can't live without it." "I don't follow," Barry said. "ValuPro?" "What?" "A month's supply went from $30 to $700 as soon as ValuPro, of which you own 20%, bought the company that made the drug." Jeff Park paused as if to let that figure register. But Barry had heard it all before. Prices went up. Shareholders profited. What part of capitalism didn't Jeff Park understand? "And I've got money," Jeff said, "so I got my dad covered. But that's how I think of people like you. I always have the same visualization. I start with a row of middle-class houses like the one my dad lives in, and then I see you. You go from house to house, from family to family, and you take money from their wallets, from their purses, from under their sofa cushions, and you put it in your pockets, and when your pockets are full, you put it in a duffel bag with the logo of your fund. You don't sneak in, you don't break in, you just walk amongst these people as if they're invisible, and you take the money they've earned. And then you go home and you buy yourself a watch or whatever." "You own a Patek 1018 in rose gold," Barry said. "That's worth over $1 million. "I'm not blameless," Jeff said. "But I have my limits, and I know who I am." "See," Barry said, "that's what I'm trying to find out on this journey, who I am." "Sure," Jeff Park said. "And then when it's over, you can tell people about it." "I'm sorry?" "You can tell them the story of how you once took a bus across the country. You can tell them about your journey." Jeff Park's Bentley entered the exciting world of Atlanta's downtown. They passed the Red Eye Bail Bonds and the Atlanta DUI Academy, which exists. A group of men had gathered outside the bus station to stare each other down with maximum malice. "Be careful," Jeff Park said. "This bus station has a bit of a reputation." The men outside were whooping it up about the car. "Bentley," they shouted. "I hope you find your 5'6" woman," Barry said. Jeff Park stuck out his hand and Barry shook it. "You're going to turn out better than me," Barry said. He grabbed his rollerboard and got out of the car before Jeff Park could say goodbye. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it. Well, if you have any questions or concerns or complaints, this would be a great time to hear them. People are coming around with big yellow mics, or blue mics, very, very colored mics. There's a person right there. Yes.
Tell me about your watch collection.
Oh, I knew this would happen. Yeah. So the moment I landed in Philly, somebody slipped a note into my pocket. It's the name of a watch dealer that I should check out. So this is a pretty watch-obsessed town. I began my watch collection in the year 2016, just as I was writing Lake Success. And I wrote a New Yorker piece about it. You can find it online, as you've seen it. I think I was starting to freak out about, you know, our country in general, and I couldn't just look at 538.com every second of the waking day. So I said, maybe it's time for a sad middle-aged hobby. I deserve one. And many people do, you know, baseball statistics, stuff like that. I don't understand baseball at all. I was born in Russia. Our only sport is kleptocracy. So I couldn't get into that. So for some reason, I don't know why, but watch has caught my fancy. I think it's, as my team of psychiatrists say, the passing of the seconds hand, the way it works on a mechanical watch with its smooth movement, unlike a quartz watch, which goes like this, a mechanical just slides across, yeah. That calms me down and puts me in a semi-hypnotic state. So I bought one watch, and then I bought another, and then nine more. And before I knew it, I was broke. I'm kidding. But my kid will not go to college, that's for sure. Who needs college? It's so overrated. Yeah, yeah. High school is fine. In this economy, that's all you need, right? Yeah. Great. Yes, but at the signing, please ask me about my watches and show me your watch. This has been, so far on this tour, I usually get asthma inhalers to sign because most of my readership is asthmatic, but this time I've also been signing watch straps. So if you have both, then you've scored some kind of double, I don't know. Wow. And if you bought a strudel, that's a triple crown. Strudel, watches, and asthma. Okay. Any other questions or concerns, horological or otherwise?
Tell me about how come it's Ben Stiller in you.
How come is it Ben Stiller in the trailer? I just know Ben for a while. We worked on a project together in good old Hollywood. And I like him. He's really funny. That video was like a masterclass in comedic improv. One of my favorite scenes is, so we had the scene, Ben says, like, bro, you might be wondering how do hedge funds work? Bro, you might be wondering what is a hedge fund? And as he does it, he throws a tennis ball, right, back. So in one take, the take you see, he missed it, right, in the middle of that dialogue. Now, if that happened to me, I would have gone, oh, my God, sorry, let's do this, let's do another take. But he just kept going, and he made it even funnier, because the idea is he's a hedge fund manager who's, you know, obviously this Lake Success Capital is just losing money left and right, and he's the guy who can't catch a tennis ball. It was just perfect, the way he improvised so quickly. And check out on YouTube, you can check out my other videos starring James Franco, Paul Giamatti, Rashida Jones. It's a real, I mean, I don't really like writing books much, but I love these trailers. I do the books just so I can do a trailer afterwards, frankly. That's the fun part. Books is a lot of typing. I have carpal tunnel. A lot of typing. Don't try it at home.
So did you have to do a lot of research to learn about hedge funds?
Did I have to do a lot of research? Yes. I spent 3 to 4 years hanging out with hedge fund people. I know. Between that and the Greyhound, I am barely alive. These people drink a lot, especially when the markets are down, which was for them most of 2017, even though the S&P was up, most funds that I followed were down. I don't know what to tell you about these people. They're very interesting. A lot of them are people who went to my high school, the Stuyvesant High School for desperately, striving immigrants. In fact, I was just at my 25th reunion, and I think half the people were in finance. I don't know. I mean, there were a couple of takeaways. I made some good friends. The friends I made were not the Wharton types, no offense to the great city of Wharton here. They were more the, you know, PhDs in math and science who were doing the quantitative part of it. So they didn't start out in finance. They kind of gravitated toward it because somehow hedge fund managers make a lot more than assistant professors of math at North Dakota State. I don't know how that works, but that's apparently how it works. But, you know, throughout the process, what I realized is that they lived these very kind of moated existences, which were mostly their Upper East Side apartment, their Midtown club, their Midtown fund, their Hamptons estate, you know, and there wasn't a lot of interaction with the real world or anything outside of that 0.01% world. So when I thought of how I would write about a hedge fund person, I thought, you know, there's already great shows like Billions, and Tom Wolfe has certainly written wonderfully about, not hedge funds, but about, you know, investment bankers. And I thought, what would be interesting would be to see somebody who lives this kind of moated lifestyle, get on, frankly, the worst form of transportation our country has to offer, and then go across the country, you know, and to be separated from all that money and to see what's left when the money leaves them. And that was the impetus for creating a Greyhound bus journey alongside the 4 years suffering with hedge funders.
So you did take the Greyhound trip?
Yes.
Cross country?
Yes. Yes.
For how long?
I got on the bus in June of 2016, and I got off in September. Now, that wasn't all on the hound. We call it the hound.
Right. Or
the dog.
Oh, right.
But I also got off in each of the cities. So Barry goes through Baltimore. He goes through Richmond, Atlanta, Jackson, Miss, El Paso, Phoenix, and then to San Diego. So I spent a lot of time in each of those cities. So that's covered as well. But yeah, it was an incredibly instructive journey. I mean, in the middle of this Atlanta chapter, there's a part I didn't read where Jeff Park and Barry go to this bar in Buckhead, this wealthy suburb, and Barry gets into a fight with these people who think that Trump's going to win the election. And that is taken from real life. There were all these people there who said, absolutely not. Trump's going to win. And he's going to win. And he's going to win Pennsylvania. And Barry slash me was like, are you kidding me? Come on. Let's look at 538 here. But throughout the bus trip, people in the middle of the country kept saying the same thing. It's not going to work out the way you think it is. So, you know, I got on the bus in June in New York. I got off in San Diego in September. I was pricing Toronto real estate by the time I got off the bus.
Right, that's what I was going to
say. Yeah.
I don't know anything about your personal life, although I've read most of your books.
Well, then you know everything about it.
But how did you learn so much about autism?
Uh-huh. Well, I've always had a lot of friends who have kids on the spectrum, and frankly, when I was dealing with hedge funders, the conversation would often be about who's on the spectrum and who's not, because so many of them, especially on the quant side, were not. So the kid in this book is, he's nonverbal. Of course, the hedge fund people I met were more on what used to be Asperger's part of the spectrum, but now there's only one diagnosis. And so I spent a lot of time researching it. But I also felt a great kinship with people on the spectrum, always have, which I think comes from growing up not knowing English in America and not knowing social cues. So standing in the mirror, practicing how I would try to make friends. Barry has his own technique too, called friend moves, where he stands in front of a mirror trying to be charming. And that's kind of how I grew up. Now, I'm not diagnosing myself as being on the spectrum, but I definitely felt, when I look back and think of all my friends who went to the same yeshiva as me, the friends I was hanging out with, the only people that would be my friends, when I think of their behavior, a lot of it was you know, stuff that you would associate with the spectrum if you know some of the so-called stereotypical behaviors. So I realized that all along I had autistic friends. And then a couple of years ago, I met Temple Grandin, in fact, had lunch with her, very drunken lunch. I think we finished a rather large bottle of Sancerre, and this was in Sea Island, Georgia, at some rich resort. And I thought, there's no such thing as an autistic person. Everyone is so different. And Temple was, you know, any stereotypes that have been left over from the years of, you know, Rain Man and all that stuff were destroyed in 10 seconds. She was talking about smashing her hotel room with a guitar. I mean, it was, you know, she communicated in perhaps a slightly different way than most of the people I know, but she communicated a lot better. And that took a lot of effort on her part and a lot of self-training, but there was always this incredibly intelligent person. And I don't want to give away too much about what happens to Shiva, who is the autistic kid that's the son of Barry and his wife, Seema, but there is a journey that he goes on as well. And there's some hope there too, a lot of hope.
As the father of an Oberlin daughter, how do we get from Stuyvesant High School to hedge funds via Oberlin?
Yeah, I know. How do we do that? Well, at Stuyvesant, I was in love with this woman, and we used to hold hands, which is the Stuyvesant equivalent of making love, you know. We may as well have been married at that point. And I was going to go to, I was going to go to McGill in Montreal, because I like to party. I like to party. I'm a father now. But in the old days, I enjoyed a drink or two, and McGill offered that quite a bit. But this woman wanted to go to Oberlin College, so I applied there, and I went there, and she broke up with me the first day I was there. That's Oberlin writ large for me. Just, you land, you're dumped. And then you spend 4 years thinking, oh my God, I'm in Ohio. We used to drive to Pittsburgh. That was like 5 hours to have fun. Pittsburgh. But Oberlin did have an amazing writing program, and they really do, and always have. And, you know, when I was growing up, I wanted to work on Wall Street, too. I was a poor immigrant. Kids made fun of me because I had a giant fur coat from the Soviet Union and kind of smelled like a gerbil all around. So I thought, you know, if I can make billions of dollars, maybe people will like me, which is exactly what happened to all the hedge fund people I met. There was some version of that story, maybe without the gerbil coat, but some version of that, of being on the periphery of things. But then I got to Oberlin, and they said, no, you're not going to be a billionaire. You're going to be a writer. And I said, all right. And here we are. Here we are. Yeah.
What do the hedge fund guys think about Donald Trump and the political situation?
What do hedge fund people think about Donald Trump and the political? Well, most of the people I became friends with were Hillary supporters, or at least sort of agnostic on the issue, or too libertarian to vote, or voting for Gary Johnson. That was the great cop-out, yeah. So I would say most of the people I met would sort of say something like what Barry says, you know, I'm socially liberal, fiscally a little conservative. That was kind of the takeaway. But the big thing, there was a hedge fund party. I went to a hedge fund party for the election night, and everyone had a meltdown, of course, because once the New York Times needle swung toward Trump, everyone was like, oh my God, everyone was calling their office. How are we going to hedge against this? You know, they didn't even give a crap about him winning. It was more like, oh my God, we're going to lose money tomorrow. But the interesting thing happened, as we know, of course, that the markets can just bounce, declined for 3 seconds and then went completely up, 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 up. I asked a fund manager I know, a Pakistani-American fund manager, I said, what is up here? And he said, I see the market as basically a middle-aged man in Ohio. You know, if he's happy, the market's happy. And he's happy with Trump, so the market is happy. That was how he described it. And whereas many other hedge fund people told me, let me give you a piece of advice, don't invest in my fund. Low-cost index funds all the way. Schwab it, my friend.
Hi, I wanted to ask if you would say something about your friendships with other writers. So I was thinking of Chiang Rai-Li, maybe.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You know, Chiang Rai-Li was a wonderful writer, native speaker, etc. He was my mentor at Hunter College in the City University of New York. I was going to go to Cornell for the MFA program. They have a great MFA program. And Chiang Rai read 30 pages of the book I was working on and said, you know, I think I can get you a book deal if you come to Hunta. And 2 weeks later, I had a book deal, you know, for my first book, Russian Deb something, whatever. And, you know, that's what writers do for one another. So since then, I've blurbed almost every book that's come my way. I haven't read them all, but there's a documentary about my blurbing starring Molly Ringwald, I believe. There's been a lot of blurbing because I really do believe in this kind of paying it forward. People have been so nice to me since I started writing that I really wanted to help others. There are writers' communities all over the place. Philadelphia, home to the famous Ken Kalfas. Woo. New York has its share. Brooklyn is so infested with writers that there's an extermination program underway. It's just too much. I can't enjoy a latte in peace. But I can't afford to live in Brooklyn anyway, which is why I'm in Manhattan. But I do also spend half the year in upstate New York in the kind of greater Rhinebeck area. And frankly, as I said before, most of my friends can't afford Manhattan anymore. And a lot of the writers have moved up there, and we've created a sort of kind of a rural Bloomsbury up there, which has been really exceptional. It's some really great people. The Mary Gateskills of the world haunt upstate, and it's wonderful. So I really found a good writer's home there. Anything from this side of the audience? Yeah.
Hey, what's up? How much of this happened in the book? Did you really exaggerate any of it? And then also, I saw Jerry Seinfeld said in the Times that he doesn't tweet jokes because he can't see people's responses, and it's hell for him for someone to come up and say they like the book. They didn't say what was right and what was wrong. So. What's your thoughts on the writing process?
Well, how much of this was exaggerated? Almost none. The only thing that I didn't do that Barry does is find a crack rock, and not for lack of trying. Everybody go on the hound, they'd be like, where's my, anyone have crack? You know, nobody had crack. I learned that crack is kind of over. I was offered a lot of Molly, which is something else. But almost everything else, you know, that happened on the hound happened to me as well, you know, that happened to Barry on the hound. There's a scene where Barry meets these white supremacists. This was, I'll call the state Louisiana. And they start talking very loudly about crucifying Muslims and Jews, you know, which actually happened on the Greyhound. And Barry gets off and buys a New Testament coloring book in Shreveport. So how much of it is exaggerated? Almost none, you know. The second part of the question was about, Seinfeld. Yeah, I have no connection to him. Look, humor is hard, and this book is the first book I've written where the themes are a little bit weightier than the typical Seinfeldian themes that I explore in my books, which I love, you know, the Seinfeldian kind of look at the world the way, you know, that kind of real, I mean, it's Jewish humor, but I think it's particularly Eastern European Jewish humor, that kind of, why even, you know, I'm a sap, a Soviet Ashkenazi pessimist, and I think, I mean, I don't even see the glass as half full. There's no glass, you know. And I think somehow the Larry David strain of people really capture that as well. So we are landsmen even though we're separated by 100 years of history. You guys are the best. Thank you so much. I'll sign anything. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.